Good evening. I'm Heather Brown, and this is Between the Covers. Last night, we started an intriguing novel by Toronto author Terence Green. Shadow of Ashland presents some puzzling elements that can't be easily explained. The story's narrator, Leo Nolan, is mourning the loss of his mother. Her dying wish had been to see her long-lost brother Jack one more time. Leo's uncle Jack had left Toronto 50 years earlier, seeking better work opportunities in 1930s America. He sent a single letter, then was never heard from again. But after Leo's mother's death in 1984, another letter arrives from Jack, postmarked April 1934. Here's Michael Hogan, reading from Shadow of Ashland.
My father was strangely composed when he handed me the letter. I wondered whether it was because he had had time to calm himself, or if it was part of the realm of old age to bear surprises with greater dispassion. In the upper right-hand corner was the same purple 3-cent Washington stamp. The postmark was as he had said. The letter was 2 standard 8.5 by 11 sheets. Atop the date on the letter was the address. 117 17th Street, Toledo. Dear Margaret, I certainly owe you an apology, and I suppose I owe all the rest of the family one, too. It just seems as though the things I should do, I never get around to, and the ones I shouldn't are always being done. I got your letter a couple weeks ago, and I've started to write you several times. I get about halfway through, and then something happens. How are you all doing? I didn't have such a good winter, but things are starting to look up now. I lost my car and just about everything else I had just before Christmas. I had a wreck and was laid up for a while, but I'm okay now. Don't think I'm an awful heel for not writing. I would have dropped you a line at Christmas, but I was in pretty bad shape, physically and financially, so I just lay low and hoped everything would be all right. I've been in Toledo now for 2 weeks. I'm still with Hardican. I was away from him for a while during the winter, but started back again. His picture business is still the biggest. I'm working with a chap named McMaster, a real nice fellow. Say, that was a dirty dig about those cards you have for me. You'd think you hadn't heard from me in over a year. Send me some snapshots of yourself and the kiddies. I'm still carrying the one of you and Ronnie and Ann on the bikes. Say hello to all the gang for me, and write me sooner than I did you. Try and forgive me for not writing sooner, because you know how a fella slips once in a while. I'm going to close now and get some sleep. So long and lots of love. Jack. The next letter arrived on June 23rd. I hung up the phone after receiving my father's call and drove over to his house in a daze. This one was postmarked June 18th, 1934, from Bucyrus, Ohio. The envelope bore the imprint of some roadside inn. The Highway, it read, on the nation's main thoroughfare, the Lincoln Highway, Bucyrus, Ohio. The letter consisted of 3 sheets of yellowed stationery, with the same letterhead as adorned the envelope. I glanced once more at the envelope. A red 2-cent Washington was aligned with a green 1-cent counterpart. I read the letter. Dear Margaret, the first thing I want to do is apologize for not writing sooner. You know how I am about letters, though. I'm still with Hardican of Detroit, but it's been so long since I've seen the office that I almost forget what he looks like. How are all the fellows in Toronto? Say hello to all the gang around the house for me. Have you been bathing this summer? I suppose Ronnie and Ann are both expert swim champs by now. There isn't very much to tell, as I've been hitting small towns along the line. If the next one is as dead as this, I'll go crazy. I don't know where I'm going from here, but we will be leaving in a few days. I'll let you know my next address in time for you to drop a line. Things are just about the same with me. I'm not making a fortune, but I will one of these days. I'm going to beat it now and get something to eat. Lots of love. Your brother, Jack. We were quiet for a long time in the kitchen. Finally, I looked at my father. Why is this happening? I asked. I watched him frown and waited. His eyes were focused on the wall behind me. I glanced sideways to see what might be there. There was nothing. Things have to be settled, he said, or they never go away. The letter that arrived on July 5th was the briefest, written on a torn piece of stationery. It was from Ashland, Kentucky. The hotel this time was called the Scott Hotel, and the letterhead underlined its features. Fireproof, moderate price, tub and shower baths. It had been postmarked July 1st, 1934. Dear Margaret, just a line to ask how you are and how things are going in Toronto. I am doing pretty well down here. I have my own car now. I've had it for a week, a Dodge Roadster. How are Tommy and the kiddies? I'll be in touch. Love, Jack. I usually take my holidays in August. I like the weather at the end of summer. I head north, rent a cottage, do some fishing. This year, I headed south. Detroit, Toledo, Bucyrus, Ashland. I had to see for myself. I told my father. He nodded, sitting in the kitchen. There was no Vermont Hotel in Detroit. An office building stood on the site where 138 West Columbia would have been. I drove on. There was no 117 17th Street in Toledo, at least not any longer. I took Route 20 east from Toledo to Bellevue, veered south on 269 to 4, then south the last 25 miles or so to Bucyrus. Route 4, the Lincoln Highway, Bucyrus. I drove back and forth along the main route twice, tasting, searching, looking for more than just the Highway Inn. In some way, I was looking for Jack. He was not here, though. I had no idea where Jack was. The next day, I got back onto 23 and took it all the way to Ashland, Kentucky. At Portsmouth, I crossed the Ohio River. It was hot and humid, as only August can be. I stopped at a Burger King for lunch, scanning the local phone books for a Scott Hotel. There was no listing. People stayed at the Ramada Inn in 1984, not the Scott. Getting into my car, I began to drive, touring the streets casually, my arm resting on the open window ledge. J.C. Penney was here. So was Wendy's, McDonald's, and Arby's. Chevron Gas, McCreary Tires, Midas Mufflers, Dairy Cheer, home of the Smashburger, ABC Drive-Thru Liquors, Sears, the Ashland Oil Company. I made a haphazard left onto 14th Street from Winchester, and I saw it. The Scott Hotel. A creaking rooming house whose very foundation had shifted, giving it a perceptible list, out of plumb with its surroundings. The sweat ran into my eyes. At least, I think it was sweat. I may have been crying. I don't know. Opening my eyes, I blinked several times. It was still there. Avatar of a bygone era, unassuming and pale. The Scott Hotel. I glanced at my watch. It was 3 p.m. Easing the car to the curb, I parked. I got out, walked up to the dilapidated front porch, noted the motionless swing seat tucked in its corner, studied the moon-shaped wells in the three steps before me, and took them smoothly, arriving at the front door. A giant oval of beveled glass, frosted at the edges, was implanted in a heavy wooden frame. A cast-iron door knocker hung to the right of the glass, chest high. I used it. Then I took a step back, waiting. When the door was pulled open, a small, wiry woman in her late 40s or early 50s stood in the hallway. Yes, can I help you? I was at a temporary loss. She smiled, tilting her head to one side. I didn't know what to ask. My journey, everything seemed impossibly foolish. I tried again. I'm looking for Jack Rady. The smile disappeared slowly. I waited. Come in, she said, stepping aside. I crossed the threshold, entering the past. We were in a parlor furnished in leftovers from the 30s and 40s. The afternoon sun streamed through partly open Venetian blinds into the dim interior, dust motes floating idly in the slanted bars of light. Sit down, She indicated the worn, wine-colored sofa, a needle-point pillow at each end. She seated herself in a threadbare easy chair, letting seconds elapse as she appeared to gather her thoughts. "Who are you?" she asked, finally. "My name is Leo Nolan. I'm from Toronto, Canada." She folded her hands. "I have an uncle named Jack Rady. My family hasn't heard from him for quite a long time. This was one of his last known addresses." Her dark eyes clouded. "When'd you last hear from Jack Rady?" 50 years ago." Her eyes closed. The dust motes drifted downward, a slow-motion waterfall. "I'm Emma Matusik," she said. "I know the name, Jack Rady." I shifted to the edge of the sofa, intent on her words. "It's from before my time. My parents own the hotel. It isn't much now, but it had its day. Jack Rady did live here off and on for quite a while, from what I understand." "When did he leave? Where did he go?" "You'd have to ask my parents that. It was a long time ago. I don't remember any of it." She hesitated, thinking. "Would you like to speak with my parents, Mr. Nolan?" "Yes," I said. The calmness of my voice masked the excitement I felt. "Very much." Her parents, I realized when I saw them, must have been 80 years old. Emma Matusik led them into the parlor, seating them on the upholstered settee at the end of the room nearest me. I rose and went over to them, offering my hand. "I'm Leo Nolan." The old man accepted the gesture, shaking my hand, then peering at me, said, "I know you." I held his hand, taken aback. I don't think so." He squinted, confusion entering his eyes. His wife had been staring too, struggling with some memory. The old man shook his head. "You look like someone I used to know. Name Leo rings a bell too." He shook his head again. "It was a long time ago." Maybe I thought I looked like Jack Rady. The old man let my hand drop. "I'm Stanley Matusik, and this is my wife, Teresa." "Pleased to meet you." I sat back down. "What is it we can do for you, Mr. Nolan?" I glanced at the daughter, wondering what she had told them. She remained silent. "I don't know if your daughter told you. I'm from Toronto, Canada. I have an uncle named Jack Rady. I understand he used to live here." For a frozen moment, no one spoke. The old woman looked up, staring directly at me. Emma said nothing, waiting. It was left for Stanley Matusik to break the silence. "Is this a joke?" His eyes narrowed. "A joke? Good Lord, no. I was taken by surprise. I don't know what you mean." The old man put his hand to his chin, spreading his thumb along his jawline. He dropped his eyes, then stared back at me. "Like I know you. Like I seen you somewhere before." He mulled it over. "Who'd you say you were?" "I'm his nephew, Jack Rady's," I said. "He was my mother's brother. My mother died recently, and one of the things she really wanted was to see Jack, or at least to know what happened to him. She hadn't heard from him in years, and one of the last addresses she had for him was here, so I thought I'd drop by and see what I could find out, since I was down this way." I added the last part in order to try to restore a casual atmosphere to my inquiries. "Yes," the old man said finally. "Jack lived here. He left a long time ago." "When?" 1935. "Where did he go?" A shrug. "Not sure." A flicker in his eyes, a candle stirred by a door opening. I tried another tack. "What did he do while he was here?" "Took pictures for a while. Then he worked at the King's Daughters Hospital." Something new. A small wedge, perhaps. "What did he do at the hospital?" "Worked as a night janitor. Can't remember how long, 6 months, a year, something like that." "And then?" "Then he left. He was gone, like that." He spread his calloused hands and stared at me. "You're young, you wouldn't know. It was the 30s. Things like that happened." I nodded. We sat in silence. "I'd like to stay for a while," I said. They seemed surprised. "How long?" the old man asked. "A week, two. Then I'll have to go back." "Well, hardly anybody stays here anymore, Mr. Nolan." It was the first time that I had heard Teresa Matusik's voice. "You might be more comfortable in a newer place, more up to date." "Of course we have room," said Emma, intercepting her mother. There's only Mr. Bannerman, Mrs. Christensen, and Miss Morris here now besides us. We'd be honored. I smiled. Thank you. I appreciate it. Then I turned to the senior couple and asked, if you can remember what room Jack stayed in, I'd like the same one. Is that possible? Mrs. Matusik's lips parted as if to say something, but nothing came out. The candle continued to flicker in Stanley Matusik's eyes. I wanted to go into the past. I couldn't help myself. The Scott Hotel was a rambling old three-story house. As I was led through it and up to the third floor, I glanced at dark turns and hallways and closed doors with tarnished brass numbers on them, aware of secrets they would not yield. Stanley Matusik plodded ahead steadily, with remarkable stamina for a man his age. When we reached the third floor, he stopped.
Nobody comes up here much anymore, he said. Too much trouble. Too many stairs.
He turned the doorknob of number 8.
Jack stayed in here.
The door swung inward and open. A white painted iron bedstead. A wooden veneer chest of drawers. Venetian blinds. A blue upholstered easy chair facing an RCA black and white TV. An oak wardrobe with a mirror inset in the door. The door closed. I was alone in Jack's room. I had traveled the Lincoln Highway, had come to Ashland. On a small table at the side of the bed was a silent round alarm clock, both hands frozen at 12. I picked it up, turned it over, cranked the winding mechanism, and listened as it began to tick. Exhausted, I lay back on the bed and closed my eyes. I drifted into the warm cavern of sleep. Dreamless.
Michael Hogan, reading from Shadow of Ashland by Terence Green. Tomorrow, Leo befriends the waitress at Woolworth's, and his father back in Toronto receives another letter from Jack. We'll end tonight's reading on a seasonal note with a poem about a blustery night in late fall. Nocturne was written by the Montreal poet Robin Sarah. It's read by Brenda Robbins.
Nocturne. She sits up late, listening to the wind in leaves that may be gone tomorrow. One gust this time of year and up they fly. There is no calling them back, and it will always happen too quickly. Midnight. In the next room, the child stirs in his crib, cries out without waking. She thinks of sleep but sits on, unmoving. A moth flops in the lampshade. The chairs cast straight shadows. What keeps her here at this hour? What, in the plainness of things, the bare floor, the broom in the corner, the tea stains on the frayed tablecloth, sharpens her nerve to the quiver of a flame end. She thinks, alive. Down the alley a dog begins barking. The tree shakes with a knowing the bones soon share.
Nocturne, a poem written by Robin Sarah and read by Brenda Robbins. It's from Sarah's book of selected poems, The Touchstone, published by Anansi. That's our program for this evening, but before we go, I'd like to remind you that the Between the Covers collection of audiobooks is available through Goose Lane Editions. Selected readings from past seasons of the program are available on CD or on cassette. For more information and to order, you can call this number toll-free, 1-888-9-COVERS. That's 1-888-926-8377. Stay tuned now for the CBC Radio 1 News. And after that, it's classical music from CBC Winnipeg on Northern Lights.